Running with Jake, the podcast.
So let me get this straight. We are on the Lovejoy Hour to tell people about our show, our podcast.
That's exactly what's going on, yes.
This is great. I can't think of anybody else's show I would rather be on talking about our show. We've got less than 60 seconds. We need to crack on.
Let's not tell everybody about how great Tim Lovejoy is because people know that already, right? Because they're listening. You got to tell them about our podcast.
So if you fancy listening to something a little bit different, we are Running with Jake, the podcast. Yes, we are a show about running and fitness and mental wellness, but we do like to have a bit of fun as well. We like to have a bit of a laugh. We keep things very real. I think that's pretty fair to say.
We do keep it real. And sometimes, just sometimes, I think we share too much.
You definitely overshare.
So, it's Running with Jake, the podcast. That's our show, and that's our time up.
Give it a listen. You never know. You might just like it.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I've been using mine for a whole lot of boiling potatoes recently. I've fallen in love with mashed potato again. Perfect lockdown food. Today's podcast, I get curious about relationships. Carol Robin and David Bradford are lecturers at Stanford. Their publicity says they're the world's leading experts on relationships with 75 years of teaching between them. They've written a book together called Connect, which says building exceptional relationships with friends, families, and colleagues. Sounds intriguing. Let's meet them. Here's Carol and David. Hello, Carol, and hello, David. How are you both?
Fine. Good to see you.
Wonderful.
First of all, I suppose you better tell us about yourself. Start with you, Carol. Tell us about your career and how you've got to get to the stage where you're writing this book with David.
Well, mine is a long, circuitous, windy road. I'm not a career academic, even though I spent my longest career was in academia. I started out in sales and marketing and industrial automation. In 1975, I was the first woman hired into a non-clerical job at a very large Fortune 500 company. So that was my first career. Then I had a meandering career. I had a stint in what I call the nonprofit world when my kids were little and in the community or space. Then I decided to go back to school because I decided I wanted to make a shift into leadership development. And I went back to school to get a master's because I didn't want to mess with people's lives and not know what I was doing. And then I decided I certainly was going to learn enough in a master's. So I got a PhD. By the way, that's sort of how my road led to David Bradford and Stanford, which I'll get to in a moment. Then I had a stint in consulting for quite a while. And I was a partner and a principal in an international consulting firm and traveled all over the world. And then one of the members of my dissertation committee suggested I go meet David Bradford at Stanford because they were teaching this interesting course that he thought I'd be good at. And on a lark, I went to see David Bradford. The rest is this, that was in 1998 when I first went to see David Bradford. The thing, by the way, that all of those careers have in common is that I was always fascinated by people.
And the course was on relationships.
And the course is actually called Interpersonal Dynamics, and affectionately known by the students as touchy-feely.
Okay. David, tell
I'm sorry,
us about
me. Talk more about the course after David tells you a little bit about him.
Yeah, tell us about yourself, David.
Yeah, my whole career has been academia. I've been plodding along in one job primarily. So I was brought to Stanford in 69 to develop this course, Interpersonal Dynamics. And at that point, it was very small, 12 students and one instructor. And so I developed a structure that allowed us to have 36 students and instructor. We increased the number of sections. Now 85% of the students take the course, it's an elective, with a waiting list. And it's the most sought after course in the MBA program. Students report frequently that it's been life-changing, transformational. And it's been the major source of satisfaction, I would think, professionally in my life.
Why does everyone want to take the course? Carol, you tell me this.
So, yes, thousands of students and alums for decades talk about how it changed their life. And we hear 10 years later from them, this course didn't just help me get promoted and help me become an executive VP or a CEO, but I think this course just saved my marriage. I think this course just helped me reconcile my relationship with my brother, who I haven't talked to for 2 years. So what they learn, which is they learn how to learn about themselves and about relationships, about what works with one person versus another, stays with them their whole life. And it continues to be useful. And I'll say one more thing, which is I left Stanford 3 years ago to round out my career and started a nonprofit called Leaders in Tech. And I've brought everything we used to teach at Stanford to founders and CEOs in Silicon Valley that are pre-IPO, so they can establish cultures from the beginning that value connection and relationships from the start, instead of trying to figure out how to make up for that after they've gone big.
So David, you might as well tell us about the book then, because we're going to talk mainly around the book. So tell us the concept behind it.
Yeah, we were approached by an editor at Penguin Random House to do the book. And it's something that Carol and I had played with for years. But the dilemma is the course is a highly experiential course. And we were faced with a dilemma of how do you translate that into a book? Because to be a little grandiose about it, we saw how it impacted the thousands of students, but we wanted to impact the world. And we wanted the reader to have a somewhat similar experience. So what we struggled with is how to, you know, conveying the concepts are simple, but how can we have the reader have a experience that's somewhat parallel to the course? And that's, I think, one of the things that's unique about the book, that we have been able to build that in.
How do you, and what's most important, do you think, when you're talking about relationships? Are you talking about work relationships or relationships with loved ones, family and friends?
Yes, with everybody. With, as the title says, with family, friends, and colleagues. It's different with each person, with each category, but it has a lot of similar dimensions. And that's what the course in the book looks at. The dimensions are, to what extent could I be myself? To what extent can we have a relationship where you can be yourself? And can we have a good element of trust and honesty with each other? Can we raise difficulties and resolve them? Those are struggles we have in all relationships. I just had a little tiff with my wife last night, and which is not unusual, I think, with anybody. And we were able to sit down and work it out and get through it. So relationships are never perfect. That's what makes them so fascinating. But they don't have to be as painful and destructive as they often are.
You're both married. Carol, how's your marriage at the moment?
my marriage has never been better. So we've been married 35 years. We just had our first grandson 3 weeks ago. Yesterday or Sunday. And here's a great example, build a little different from what David was talking about, of how relationships can continue to deepen and how much more fulfilling and rewarding a life is where you've got tools to continue to deepen a relationship when you want to. It's the tools just expand your choices. So my husband had said to me a couple of weeks ago, so how are you going to feel if the kids don't really want us around, the new baby, all that much? And I said, well, I would totally understand. I mean, they're trying to create their new family, and, you know, that would seem perfectly reasonable to me. And he said, no, Carol, I asked you how you would feel. And by the way, the queen of touchy-feely, that's what I was called at the school. I make a living helping people access and talk about their feelings because it's a way to build relationship. And even I responded with a thought. And by the way, if I had said, I feel that it'd be perfectly reasonable. That wouldn't be a feeling. That's in the book, as you well know,
yeah.
The distinction. So he caught me. And then I said, wow, well played. I don't know. I guess I'd feel crappy and disappointed. I said, what's behind your question? He said that I'm feeling vulnerable, that they won't want us around as much as I'm going to want to be around. And I wondered, whether that's what was going on for you too.
And what do you do with that thought then? I mean, I know as humans, we're passing our problems, our stresses, our frustrations onto each other constantly because we're connected. Do you pass that information onto your children so they can carry the guilt, or do you just have to live it with your husband?
Well, first of all, I'm loath to say this is what you do. Every relationship is unique. You know, one size doesn't fit all. What's germane about the exchange with my husband is that it brought us closer. We don't have to do anything, but we understand each other at an even deeper level. We feel even more connected to each other. And by the way, that might be enough. It might be, and in fact, where we went was, well, let's hold each other in check here so that we don't overwhelm our kids.
David, you were going to say something there?
Yeah, is that it's really communicating on two levels. We use the analogy in the book about music, is that treble is our thoughts and bass are the feelings. And full communication is both of them. And we tend to pretend we're Mr. Spock and Star World and cut out all feelings. And
it's
truncated. As Carol's saying, it's not a matter of laying on problems. It's a matter of being known. And Andy, her husband, wanted to know how she was feeling. He didn't go in and make nicey-nicey. That's not the purpose. So it's a way to connect.
Right. And nor did I feel burdened. In fact, I felt freer. I felt met. And he felt even more met.
Yeah, will you let your children be aware that you are feeling uneasy about the amount of contact you will have with the grandchildren?
If I believe it will serve our relationship and strengthen it, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Now,
go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I find fascinating about the world is that you do definitely have different types of relationship, understandably, different ones with your friends and your family and your children, everything. But the real distinction is work versus, and you talk about it a lot in your book, work versus personal relationships, because work is more of a game, isn't it? That it doesn't apply to the same rules. If someone in your friendship group is horrible to you, you can walk away. Often in work, you're lumbered and stuck with these people, and the parameters are slightly different. The game is slightly different. Is that true?
It's partially true, but remember, organizations are network of relationships, and as everybody knows, if you've got strong relationships in that network, you're going to be much more effective. Yes, I could walk away from a friend who bothers me, but that's not going to strengthen the relationship. And we don't expect in work that it all are going to be deep or so on, but they can be strong. I want a work relationship where I can be honest. I want a relationship where I can, and Carol and I have worked for 4 years in this book, and numerous times we've said, hey, I'm bothered by what you did. And we clean it up and then move on. So there still is the same need, even though there are some important differences. And the differences are that there are power differences between you and your boss. But it's also a skill to build an honest relationship with your boss. It just has to be a little more careful. So I think there are differences that can't be ignored, but the overlap is very, very strong.
I want to add that, regrettably, too many people think about organizational life as I've got to leave half of myself in the parking lot. I've got to leave the feeling part of myself, the empathetic part of myself, the part of myself that actually cares about other people. I have to leave that in the parking lot. And by the way, the extreme version is I got to leave all my feelings in the parking lot, other than anger. Anger, I guess, is okay in business. But you know what? We are so poorly served by that mental model, because if we show up as full human beings, then we're wired for connection, as Brené Brown says. And if we will just acknowledge that and learn how to do that productively in business, we'd have far more functional relationships in business than asking us to leave half of ourselves in the parking lot.
Very true. However, you have to tread lightly sometimes. I'm a TV presenter. And if you go back 10 years ago, I had very bad mental health problems. And I was still functioning TV presenter, and I never told anybody, because maybe it was 15 years ago, but I always thought that if I told people, they'd try and slide me out the door. Now, if I told anyone, they'd go, "Oh, how can we help you?" The landscape has changed dramatically with mental health, but 15 years ago, it was a good idea to keep my mouth shut. You know, I'm fine, by the way, now. I'm not fine, but I'm never fine. But it's work in progress always. But, you know, it feels good. So I had to be careful and tread carefully. I noticed right at the beginning of your book, you talk about, and I love this bit about it, actually, about trying to share and share opinions. That scares the hell out of me. And you've got your 15% rule, which I quite like. Do you want to explain that, David?
Yeah. But I want to go back to your example, which is a wonderful one. You have to be judicious. This isn't a let me just let everything hang out with everybody. I'm going to be different with different individuals in different situations. Really want to legitimize that. So what we do in relationships is we test out how far we can go. And the 15% rule, so I want you to think of three concentric circles. There's the inner smaller circle, which is safety, my comfort zone. Then there's a ring around it, which is the 15%. And then there's a ring beyond that, which is a danger zone. And you want to avoid the danger zone, as you did 15 years ago, quite wisely. And the 15% rule is, in my interaction, can I be 15% riskier or 15% a little more uncomfortable? Not 45%, and certainly not 100%, and test it out. And it's likely not to be disastrous. And if the other person changes the subject and clearly doesn't want to have a discussion at that level, fine. But I've tested it out. And it's likely that when I move 15%, the other person will reciprocate. And then maybe I can feel a little more comfortable and move a little bit further out of my comfort zone. And that's how relationships get built.
Can it be a one-way thing? Does the person you're trying to have a relationship with, do they have to read the book as well? Or can you be the one manipulating the relationship totally from the knowledge you receive from your book?
Well, for starters, I really don't like the word manipulate.
I don't think David did either, because he started laughing a lot.
that would not be the word I would ever use to describe our work. And so I got a little stuck in your question with that word. So look, I spent 10 years in sales and marketing, and you can take the girl out of sales, but you can never take the sales out of the girl. So my recommendation is you should both pick up the book and read it together, because if in fact you're trying to use all of the tools in the book, you're going to get much farther, much quicker. Okay. Now I'll set the sales hat aside. And I'll say this, are you likely to get more traction quicker if you both have the knowledge and the tools? Yes. Is that the only way you're going to make progress? Absolutely not. So our students, of course, who are in class, are learning how to develop all these skills and competencies and practicing with each other all the time. And they go use it with people in their life who have never taken the course. And they find it incredibly helpful. And they find that it really transforms their relationships with people who've never taken the class or had the book, by the way, until now.
Carol, do you find it like a superpower once you know the secrets? Secrets isn't the right word, really, is it? But when once you know more about having how to have a good relation, do you find it a superpower?
No, I find it an opportunity. It gives me choices. I've got to admit, it does have somewhat of a little cost. And that is, I find relationships where I can be myself and I can be honest so much more rewarding that I get bored pretty easily with chit-chat. And Eva, my wife, kids me, if we're at a party, you know, I don't want to talk much about the Super Bowl. It was a bore anyway. I'll find somebody who seems sort of interesting and I want to get to know them. And so I ask questions and I show that I'm interested, not to treat them like an object under the microscope, but as a way to get to know them. And when they see that I'm interested, they ask about me a little bit. And these give me choices to build the sort of relationships that I want. Not all of them are deep, but they're more meaningful than they've been before. And those that aren't meaningful, I don't like to spend a lot of time with.
David, can I just expand on that? Because that always fascinates me. I have a big problem with small talk too. And so I was listening to a couple of podcasts on this, and it seems to me that a conversation is just a sequence of signaling. I'm saying to you, like I'm doing on this interview now, I'm going, here are my questions, judge me on this. And you're going, here are my answers and here are my thoughts, judge me. And we're having this like little play thing where we're signaling to each other. And when you first meet someone, that's kind of what you're doing, isn't it? It's a sequence of signaling to tell the person who you are. I'm not a Trump supporter, or I don't like the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true. And if this were a conversation just between you and me, rather than you doing a podcast, I would really want to follow up on your experience 15 years ago and what cues you used. And then I would probably share the fact that I've been in therapy and found that helpful. And I'm also judicious about who I tell that I've been in therapy. That if I'm in the rural Midwest, I'm probably not going to share that very much. But if I'm in San Francisco or New York, that's easy conversation. Mm. So we would go back and forth, I hope, and get to know each other. Because I've got to say, I'm sort of intrigued with your experience. And we could talk more about it.
Well, just for a bit more signaling on that, then is I never really talk about my mental health. I don't really like to say issues, but my mental health experiences on television, because everything on TV moves so quickly, and I think it needs a little bit of nuance to discuss these things. And I only ever really talk about it on podcasts because we have enough time that I think, well, okay, I can bring this into a conversation. But you know, there you go. Carol, do you want to add something?
So that's a great example of how of the reciprocal nature of relationship building. That's what David was talking about. That's what you're just talking about, which is I tell you a little bit about me. You're more inclined to tell me a little bit about you than I'm inclined to tell you a little bit more about me. That's what you two have been talking about right here. And I think if we come back to the superpower question, which you asked me a few minutes ago, it's the superpower is feeling empowered to build relationship. That's why the word manipulation we both winced at.
Apologies.
So I find it empowering to have tools at my disposal and an experience at my disposal that gives me the choice to build a deeper relationship.
Yeah, apologies about manipulation. My language can be clumsy sometimes.
No, not. It helped to clarify. You see, look what happened. You said something, and we clarified it. And I think the podcast is richer because of it.
Exactly.
Okay. I suppose what you're saying, Carol, is, and David, is when you have a relationship which is healthy, it means you can be true to yourself and actually live a true life. And I think a lot of us are walking around, especially in the workplace, never being the true person we are. And often in relationships, marriages, as we see, and friendships. Is that true?
Yes.
And in fact, one of the reasons that my Leaders in Tech program that I started has been so successful is that these CEO founders find that they've been spinning their image for their whole life. And when they find themselves in a situation where they can allow themselves to be more known and seen for who they really are, and then affirmed, it's life-changing. You asked us earlier, why was the course life-changing? That's what the students experience too, which is, oh, I'm going to let you see a little bit more of who I really am, which takes risk. But then when I do, you respond positively to me. Well, then I feel less trapped by this image I've had to spin and continue to uphold, perhaps the way you might have felt 15 years ago. And then it turns out that, yes, in certain circumstances, as David says, and maybe at a different point in time, you find out that people are actually more drawn to you and you're more effective in connecting with them by telling them something you thought you needed to keep hidden.
Let me build on that and make the distinction between, there's a difference between withholding parts of myself, which may be appropriate in certain situations, and spitting an image. And the trouble with spitting an image is it's a lose-lose situation, two ways. If by some chance I'm able to fool you with my image, it's basically invalidating to me. Because the message is the real David isn't nearly as good as the image. So the real David is really pretty, pretty poor. But there's another way it's a lose-lose. It's usually not successful. So what I say to our students who are very smart, I say, you think you're good at two competencies. You think you're good at conning other people, and you think you're good at seeing through when somebody cons you. You can't have it both ways. And I think most people are much more skilled at seeing through when somebody cons them than they are at conning other people.
Interesting. And whilst we're here, I might as well talk about it. There's varying studies happening at the moment where they say that the growth of the narcissist due to society and various other things is you know, it's really on the rise. The graph is really going very steep on that, apparently. I mean, they are people who especially enter the workplace, very successful people, you know, your last president might have had some of those things. So they can get very successful and rise all the way to the top. It's very hard to have a relationship with a narcissist, isn't it? Do you ever go into these thought processes and discussions? Because you really have to just kind of walk away from those people. They're not going to play the to and fro of having a decent relationship, are they?
Yeah, the more narcissistic, you know, people have said to me for the last 4.5 years, my God, Carol, why don't you go see if you can't get in to see, you know, Donald Trump, you know, coach him. And I've said, you know, I've coached some challenging individuals in my life, but you have to want to be coached. You have to want to learn. You have to want to deepen a relationship. And if you're a narcissist, by definition, you don't really care about a relationship. So, you know, that begs sort of a different set of competencies, which is how do you deal as productively as possible with a narcissist? That's different than trying to build a really solid, wonderful relationship with them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've got something you want to add, David.
I think that's good.
It's a strange thing to say, isn't it, that we're going to educate you, teach you on how to have a relationship. We assume we're just born with the skills to do it. David, what did you initially see that you thought people need to learn more about how to have a relationship? What was it you noticed all those years ago when you decided to design this course?
Well, the course is based on a certain methodology of learning from each other. And I had that methodology, which was why I was brought to Stanford. And what I was seeing when we were starting to introduce it was that students were at first careful, a little cautious. And then the changes that they occurred in the 10 weeks of the term and subsequently was so powerful and so satisfying. You see, one of the problems of being a teacher is you wonder whether the students really take anything away. And 6 months later, have they remembered a damn thing about the course? It is so rewarding, as Carol was saying, and this happened to me last week, when a person said, I took this course 20 years ago and I still use that material. And when I was starting to see that and hear it, it said to me, this is really what I want to do. This is so satisfying. And it fits my values. My values are, want to be as honest as we can be and as caring as we want to be. Because central to this is a notion of, I care enough, the phrase we use, the old Hallmark card, I care enough to say the very worst. If I see you shooting yourself in the foot, it's an act of kindness for me to say, hey, why are you doing that? Please stop.
I think this is
the other thing is that I actually, to your point about aren't we born with this? I actually think we're born with a lot more capacity for this. And then we unlearn. We are socialized. We are expressing feelings is socialized out of us. Watch little kids sometimes. They are very clean and direct in their their exchanges. You know, this is in the book, as you well know. You know, my kids are playing, this is a long time ago, because they're now all grown up, but you know, they're 4 and 6. And I hear my daughter say to my son, you know, Nick, that's the third time you've picked the game and I don't like that. I want to pick the next game. And, you know, and he says, yeah, let's finish this. They finish what they're playing. She says, okay, now we're going to play Candyland. He says, no. He says, okay, now we're going to play dominoes. She said, no, I said, I pick the next game. I want to play Candyland. He says, I don't want to play Candyland. I want to play dominoes. She said, okay, if you know, I want to play Candyland. I said, I pick the next game. If I don't pick the next game, I'll be in my room. You can come get me when you're ready to let me pick the next game. She didn't know yet to call him a bully, to say you're mean, to say, you know, to disempower herself and say, oh, well, I guess he's my older brother. I'm going to have to do this. Very clean. You did this. I didn't like it. Here are the consequences. She went off to her room. He came running into the kitchen and said, Mommy, Molly won't play with me. I said, I'm sorry, honey. That's not what I heard. She was very clear. So then he went down the hall and said, okay, Molly, we can play Candyland, but can we play dominoes afterwards? She said, yes, we'll take turns. They played the rest of the afternoon. And guess what? We unlearned that.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a, we're born as with all the empathy we need and the humor and everything else you talk about in the book, but then we have outside influences. For my example, again, as soon as I entered the television industry, I was told it's cutthroat, it's ruthless, watch your back. I actually don't think it is, if I'm honest with you, but I was always like, oh my God, everyone's going to do it.
Oh yeah.
The lessons from Hollywood are the winner, Wolf of Wall Street, whatever film you look, the winner is probably someone dynamic, takes risks, go for it, you know, Tom Cruise or someone. And and the and very singular, the heroes of films potentially, and the winner of sports, Tom Brady. Let's talk about him. If you start reading articles about Tom Brady, he'll be singular, he'll be selfish, he'll be determined, he'll be all these things which don't lend themselves to being empathetic and you know and sharing and caring, and because to win sport, that's how we're told you have to do it, you know. LeBron James, Michael Jordan, all Tiger Woods, you look at any of the documentaries, these guys are singular and determined, and I wonder if we start learning that that's the way we should be.
Yeah, I think Hollywood is a poor teacher, unfortunately. And I think we also don't fully understand it. So my favorite sport, particularly in the Bay Area, is basketball, because the Warriors are a powerful team. And they're a powerful team because they collaborate, because they pass the ball. So I'm going to tell a family story, which I think speaks to it. When my daughter was, I guess around 10 years old, she came back from school and she said, we beat the boys in basketball. Now, Kendra wasn't a tall girl. I was impressed. I said, really? I said, how did that happen? She said, we pass the ball, they hold on to it. And I thought, that's a great lesson. And I think in most situations, we need to pass the ball. So let's take, sometimes there's a brilliant boss who is cutthroat and gets the top, but as soon as he or she makes a mistake, the knives are out. Nobody has that person's back. And Satchel Paige, the famous black ball player, said, no one of us ain't as smart as all of us. And I think a leader who builds a strong team where they can be open, and we help executives do this all the time, where we can be open, we can collaborate, that's the team that wins.
It's interesting. Interesting talking about sport. I've worked a lot in sport, and we have a situation over here where it was all about teams with our football or soccer, as you call it. In the last 20 years, it's really turned to the individual. Yeah, you know, I put this a lot down to the sponsorship. Nike obviously went and got Michael Jordan, and they turned the balls into Michael Jordan. And similarly over here, I don't know if you know our players, Ronaldo and Messi in Europe, and you know whoever else we have in all the Premier League teams. And the sponsorship brands, because it works so well, aim at one person and not a team anymore. And I think we're getting away from the point here, but actually the team is what we want to support. But the reality is we're sold the individual.
Yeah.
Well, and what you're talking about is short-term results versus long-term sustainability. And that's part of the problem in the Valley, that too many folks are in a short-term, gotta win, and I'm in this to make a ton of money and get out, and then it doesn't matter. And by the way, a wonderful environment for a narcissist.
How important is empathy? How important is role reversal, sticking yourself in somebody else's shoes when you're having a relationship to understand what they're feeling?
I think it's crucial. I think if I can't put myself in the other person's shoes, I can't really understand them. And empathy, we make the distinction between empathy and sympathy, and that's a crucial difference. Sympathy is, I may feel sad for you. Empathy is, I really understand you. And if I understand you, then I know what's important to you, and we can start to do something about it.
And I want to add to this, because I think it's really important. I may think, boy, you're really sad about that. That wouldn't make me sad. That's not the point. The point is, I know sadness. I have experienced sadness. And so what's important is that I understand that that's what makes you sad. But where we get off a little bit is, why are you sad? Well, that's not going to make you feel more emotionally met. All I have to do is connect to the feeling, and we're back to why it's called touchy-feely. We're back to why feelings are such a crucial component to building really strong relationships.
Yeah, I have to say to give your book a bit of a sell, there's examples all the way through it, and exercises. There's examples of situations all the way through it. And then there's exercises. Then there's the actions you can take. So I imagine it's one of those things that you can read it, and then you can go, right, I'm going to give this a go tonight with my partner, and then, and then actually see what happens. So it's quite an exciting real life adventure you can do.
Yes.
Oh, thank
and,
you.
And that's where the learning will occur. You'll get the concepts reading the book, but as you say, at the end of each chapter, we have self-reflection and suggestions for application. That's where the learning is going to occur. And you and the reader will make mistakes, but can you learn from it? Mm. Somebody once said, I remember more than one executive who said, I've never made a mistake. I've only had learning opportunities.
Brilliant. And,
it can be painful, but it can be rich.
Can I just run through a couple more things from the book? The six hallmarks of exceptional relationship. Can you give us an example of some of those things that you're looking at to realize that you are having an exceptional relationship with somebody?
So one of them is that you deal... Do you want to just pick one, or?
Yeah, well, I don't want to. Just to give us a flavor of the sort of things people are going to get from reading the book.
So, one of the hallmarks is that you deal with conflict productively. And a great example of it is the last chapter in the book, but that's a very extreme version of it, which is where, you know, I wrote David off and said I'd never talk to him again. And then we not only did we come back and reconcile our relationship, but then ended up writing a book together. But we have opportunity. The closer we are, the more likely we are to have rubs. So, you know, David and I, in the process of writing the book, and even in the process now, have our occasional skirmish. And one of the things that we've learned to do is, first of all, name it early, the minute it's happened. Second of, and you know, some of this is pinch theory, which is also in the book, yeah. But some of it is you get into conflict and you see things differently. I think we should do this. No, I think we should do that. Mm. And instead of trying to make each other right or wrong, what we try to do is get underneath what's happening. Why is this such a, you know, why am I getting so spun up about this? Why is this such a big issue?
Yeah. Can I add to that just quickly? One of the six hallmarks is both of you willing to be vulnerable. That is terrifying for every human. Something we're not good at, isn't it?
It's true.
But you cannot have an exceptional relationship in the absence of willingness to be vulnerable. By definition, you've got to take some risks. Now we're back to, you don't go willy-nilly. An exceptional relationship doesn't happen at the snap of a finger. It builds over time. I'm a little vulnerable. If I play my cards close to the chest, you will play your cards closer. And then I will play my cards closer. And pretty soon, we call that a progressive impoverishment. So, you know, somebody's got to take a risk, and then somebody's got to reciprocate. But vulnerability. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, let's unpack vulnerability a bit. We usually think it's sharing something from the past which was illegal, immoral, or fattening. And I think real vulnerability often comes down to sharing how I'm feeling right now about our interaction. Do I feel hurt? That's really vulnerable. And it's easier for me to go from hurt to anger than I protect myself. Am I, in a sense, feeling a bit put down by your comment? That for me is really vulnerability. But what we find is that, and again, you don't do this in all situations, it depends on what you have built so far. But if you're willing to share how you're feeling right now about this interaction, then I come over as much more human. And it's likely to get you to move from this to you being a little more open. So, and again, I want to come back to the work situation. There's vulnerability and there's vulnerability. But what we have seen, at least I've seen, I think Carol has as well, that when leaders are vulnerable about being human, that's very different. And a quick story I'll tell is I was sitting in on executive meeting of a Fortune 500 company. Bill, the CEO, they had just come back last week from his father's funeral, who had started the company. And Bill set aside the agenda and said, let me tell you how I'm feeling, not only about the loss of my father, but the awesome responsibility I now feel. And he talked a bit about that. And you could feel the team coalesce around him and want to help him.
Mm.
He didn't say, I'm inadequate. He wasn't. But he was talking about how he was feeling. That's vulnerability.
Interesting.
And if we come back to the point I was making about productive conflict, embedded in that is what David is talking about. If I can, in the moment, also talk about how I'm feeling, and David can talk about how he's feeling, and we can hear each other, then the conflict moves beyond who's right and who's wrong. It moves into learning more about each other and being invested in each other and having a stronger relationship, which is why we both believe so strongly that conflict isn't something to be run away from, but rather lean into, because there's a ton of learning for both of you in it.
Hmm. Interesting times at the moment. We got the pandemic going on, which is affecting everyone in the world. And I did a podcast and I was feeling in the first lockdown we had in UK, we're on a third now, but the first one I was in pieces. I was all over the place, didn't really know what was going on. And so I decided to start doing some podcasts on it. And I think my summary of it, the two reasons why I was struggling so much is A, we didn't have clear leadership. Apologies to everyone who's really into our government who's listening to this. But in fairness to all governments, they didn't really know what they were doing, were they? So it was chopping and changing all over the place. And I didn't feel like we had, like New Zealand had or somewhere where they had a direct sort of action. This is what we're doing and we're sticking to it. And the other thing was I suddenly missed all the relationships I had with humans. I was mm-hmm. denied them and I'm locked away. And the only way I can do it is by speaking to people on a computer screen like I'm doing with you two now. And I think it really affected all of us. Do you think there's been a massive impact on humans because of that? Let's go to you, David.
Yeah, I think absolutely, because what we tend to do when we are Zooming is that we tend to cut to the chase and talk about the facts. I have a colleague who said, boy, I've really become effective in this. I all that other stuff. And I say, what is that other stuff? That other stuff is what's happening to me. So, and I think that's why we have a rise in drinking, in divorce, in spousal abuse, because we are missing those human interactions, and we can still have them with Zoom if we remember that what we're cutting out may be the way to have the most personal connection.
Mm. Can we throw social media in there as well? Because in the years that you've been doing the course, I'm sure when you started, social media wasn't that more prevalent in society. Now it's absolutely huge. People communicate more. In this country, they've taken the data away from phone calls, I'm told, and just stuck it all on texting because that's what we're all doing these days. And it seems to have cut out the actual communication.
Well, I would say that we're not communicating. We're talking or we're conveying information. But it's the social media, and I'm not on Facebook, I don't like it, is all spinning. It's not me communicating with you. It's me telling you all the great things I'm doing. Stop being human. And I make you envious and make you feel bad. You know, the research is the people who are on it a lot feel worse about themselves. And that's a sad outcome.
Can I ask you a question, Carol?
I can summarize it all into the difference between contact and connection.
Let me ask you a question. We're told a lot over here that because people have been working from home, that the future might be working home. Well, I'm listening to you two just talk to me now. And I feel if we are working from home via email and Zoom, we're missing important connections, which is what you're talking about. And I also, just to add on to that, I assume if you want to have a really good conversation with your boss or a work colleague or a relative or a friend, it's probably best not to do it in an email.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Email absolutely. Is a worse form. And there's research now out which shows that phones, talking on the phone, is much more effective than email. And certainly don't raise criticism by email, because you're losing all the information. I think that the evidence is that a email conveys, I think the research is 85% of the information that's conveyed face-to-face. We lose all the nonverbals. We lose a tonality. And we are asking to be misunderstood.
And I want to put a plug in for face-to-face, Zoom, FaceTime, et cetera, because it's better than nothing. It's way better than email. Phone and face-to-face on any kind of medium like this gives you a fighting chance. And if you double down on a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, because our tendency is to get very task-oriented, as David was saying, we got something to do, we got something to discuss, well, we're just going to discuss it, we're going to get off. But the task has become more and more foregrounded, while the relationship building has become more and more backgrounded. And so if you're a leader, if you're a manager, if you're talking to your parents, you know, rather than foreground the, you know, what are you going to do about the, you know, the lockdown, and how are you going to get your groceries, you can foreground some of the relationship building aspects of the conversation, you don't have to lose as much. And to your point, you know, people are thinking, well, this is not going to be a hybrid world. And more and more people are going to do this because they've discovered how convenient it is not to have to dress below the waist. I think, yes, and even more important, to double down on all the stuff we've been talking about.
My friend was telling me the other day that my Zoom technique wasn't good enough because I should be above looking down, because that gives me a sense of superiority. And I said, well, it's probably true, but when I'm interviewing people on the podcast, I don't want them to think that I'm superior. I want them to think that I'm an equal to them. But I thought that was really interesting, that Zoom now, there's people playing games with the communication, even on Zoom these days. Yeah. I'm talking about equality there. Do you think that the perfect relation is one which is equal, totally equal? And can we ever achieve that, especially in a marriage or a partnership?
It's not, never an end state. Even I've been married 57 years, and we still are learning things about each other and adapting and having to adapt as we get older and as we face what the future is like. There's always possibility for growth. And so we don't want to hold it out as some sort of nirvana that you arrive at. We want to say it's a process, and the process of building the relationship is a process of connecting. And again, not every relationship should be deep. It should be exceptional. It takes too much work. We need different people, different friendships for different things. I want somebody to go to a show with. I want somebody else to go to a hike with. I don't have to have that be the most deep one, but I do with, I want a deep relationship with Carol. I want a deep relationship with my wife, certainly with my children. That's where I'm going to put my effort. And other relationships, I want to be good. And I can make them satisfying, even if they're not exceptional.
I want to go back to the question that you asked about, do they have to be equal? Which is, they have a relationship as David just said, is going to flux a lot over time. Sometimes one person is going to you know, is going to have a little bit more say and be a little bit stronger in moving the relationship in a direction. Sometimes the other person is going to. So
or more needy with our difference in needs.
Right, difference in needs. Or like sometimes my needs are being more met than Andy's. But if at some other times his needs aren't more met than mine, then we're going to have a problem over time. So it's the thing to you know, that's why we talk a lot in the book about relationships in balance. Hmm. Balance doesn't, you know, doesn't necessarily mean equal. It means, and that's kind of maybe more complicated than we have time for.
I must reiterate, all this is in the book. There's great examples of it. We're coming towards the end of our hour, and I've got questions that I want to ask all my guests, which I want to ask you too. We haven't even covered own your own emotions, which is important, and humor, which is important. And one of the other things, which as a TV presenter, I think is the skill you need most, which is listening. And I think in relationships, you put it in the book. Listening is so important, isn't it? Which yes. is what we're trying to do here. Let me ask you the questions that I ask all my guests. So I'll start with you, Carol. What is the one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life? What one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life would you like to share with our viewers?
People do business with people.
Love it. Great. Okay, David, same question.
Well, I love Oscar Wilde's statement, be yourself, everybody else is taken.
Ah, love that too. I suppose, Carol, just to go back to that, we keep moving away from that, don't we? Often people talk about it. I think there's a book on this, actually, someone was telling me the other day. Often people talk about companies and they say, but so-and-so, this company has said that. There's always a human behind the company who has to make the decision. At the moment, I mean, we're getting towards AI, but at the moment, there's still a human which is making decisions. And you should really try and find the human if you want to talk to someone.
Precisely. You know, organizations, you know, people ascribe, you know, there's a term like anthropomorphized, or I don't remember the term, but people think of an organization as a human being. It's not. Mm. As David said earlier, it's a network of human beings all trying to do something.
Yeah, great.
But the fact is that when we forget that people do business with people, then we start thinking that as a person, I'm doing business with an idea or a product or a strategy or money. I'm not. I'm doing business with another person.
I'll stay with you for my final question. I ask all my guests this. What's the meaning of life, Carol?
Rich, rewarding, fulfilling relationships and learning and growing.
David?
I would like to add that. I think the meaning of life is to make the world better. That's my meaning. And that's what we hope the book will do. That's my responsibility, is to make the world better than when I entered it.
That's a good idea, actually, because as humans, we're forever evolving. Hopefully, one of the things we're evolving to do is make the world, well, we're ruining the world at the moment, but hopefully we're trying to make the world better by communicating better and having better relationships. How is your relationship, you two, at the moment? Are you okay after doing some promo for the book?
How are we, David?
I think we're good. you know, we... I think we're good because the other character, you were asking about the six characteristics. One is, can I be honest with the other? Can I trust the other? And Carol and I are honest with each other about also our differences. And I trust that she's going to be honest with me and is concerned for me. She's not going to knife me. She may be
but that's also related to another of the characteristics of an exceptional relationship, which is commitment to each other's learning and growth. And so there's never a question for either of us that whatever we say to each other comes out of both a commitment to the relationship, but also a commitment to each other's learning and growth. which, by the way, ties both of our what's the meaning of life.
Exactly right. Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed today's conversation. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Best of luck with the book. I've thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tim.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.